Welcome to the Industrial IoT Spotlight, your number one spot for insight from industrial IoT thought leaders who are transforming businesses today, with your host, Eric Walenza.
Welcome back to the Industrial IoT Spotlight podcast. I'm your host, Eric Walenza, CEO of IoT One, and our guest today will be Bob Sharon, founder and CEO of Blue IoT. Blue IoT develops and delivers smart building environmental management systems that integrate their Encompass Blue platform with edge computing technologies, wireless sensors, and open source analytics solutions. In this talk, we discussed how improvements in wireless connectivity, cloud computing, open source APIs, and SaaS operating models enable more flexible and cost-effective solutions. We also explored the potential benefits of improved building management systems, including reductions in carbon footprint, energy and maintenance costs, as well as improvements in cybersecurity, employee health and wellness, and productivity. If you find these conversations valuable, please leave us a comment and a five-star review. And if you'd like to share your company's story or recommend a speaker, please email us at team@iotone.com. Thank you.
Bob, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Yep, my pleasure.
So Bob, you're running this company, Blue IoT, and that I think will be the focus of our conversation today. But before we get into the discussion of what solutions you're bringing to market, I want to understand a bit more about your background and how you ended up founding Blue IoT back in 2016. I see you've been very active in a lot of different organizations in Australia. Can you just walk us through the path that led you to starting this company?
Yeah, sure. That's a very good question, actually. Well, basically, I come from an IT background. One of my first jobs was operating an old IBM 360 computer with cards. Mind you, it was ancient when I got there and we had to retire it very quickly. That machine ran on assembler, which few people will be aware of today. It's basically machine language. And then in the 90s, worked with a company in Australia. We were the first distributors for the first commercial firewalls, Checkpoint. And we flew out the CEO, still the CEO of Checkpoint, Gil Shwed from Israel, in 93, ran seminars around the country and sold our first commercial firewall in 1994. And then in the early 2000s, from working in the mid-range space, I got into data centers and basically became a bit of a data center nerd, bit of a subject matter expert around data centers. And currently I'm a global data center judge for the Broad Group, and they do Global Data Cloud Awards, of which I'm one of their global judges. We do it for love. We don't get paid, so we're kind of weird with that. Then my problem was I was a square peg in a round hole, to quote Steve Jobs. I did not fit the corporate mold. I would call a spade a spade. And, of course, you don't do that in big companies. That can be a career-limiting move. So in 2012, I started a company called Green Global Solutions. That is around sustainable data centers and office buildings. However, in those days, electricity was still quite cheap and a lot of people paid lip service to sustainability. I also made a lot of mistakes in the operation of that business, and so that did not work. So that was about 4 years or so with that experiment. But then I came to realize the future was very much around data-driven operations, data-driven automation, building smart cities. And so I formed Blue IoT in June 2016. And the point of the blue in that is the blue economy. What does it take to build something? What does it take to maintain it? What effect does it have on the people using it? And what effect does it have on the planet as a whole? So that's the blue. And IoT is not some great, wonderful technology, but rather it is an enabler. Some people try to flog IoT and sell IoT. Oh, why don't you buy this IoT widget? Isn't it great? Well, why is it great? What's it going to do for me? And a lot of people don't understand this. It is only an enabler. And so we leverage the Internet of Things as an enabler to support smart buildings, smart cities, smart places, smart assets. And so we started on the journey back in 2016. It was a very lonely, tough road back then. We tried different things to experiment with in terms of how we're going to pick up data. what type of, are we going to use ZigBee? Are we going to use Wi-Fi? Are we, what are we going to use? What platform as a workhorse? And so I can go into technical details, but we can do that later. But we then selected a very robust protocol that is cyber secure. It is a non-IP network, so we can ensure a greater level of cyber security and lower risk. And at the same time, we then were able to build and develop the world's first virtual building management platform. But my background is, yeah, very much that IT space, but then tried some things around the entrepreneurial side, failed in the first one, and now certainly moving on to more appropriate things.
I mean, I can see you're very deeply embedded in the Australian, ecosystem, both around the, environmental and also IT technologies. Australia, I think before everybody got distracted with this COVID-19 crisis, Australia was having also a fairly public crisis around the forest fire this year. What is the landscape or the mindset right now in Australia? I mean, has this really fundamentally shifted how people think about environmental conservation and technologies to reduce our impact on the environment? What have you seen over the past 5 years in terms of the evolution of the conversation around the importance of these technologies in Australia?
I think the discussion has been framed incorrectly. Look, I remember when I met Marshall Saunders in San Diego about 3 years ago. I had the privilege of meeting the founder of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and I met him in San Diego at his headquarters. And when I explained to him the way I talk to people about the environment, see, a lot of people say, global warming or climate change, and they just say, okay, well, we've got to shut everything down. Well, unfortunately, that's the wrong discussion to have. You can't play with people's lives. You've got to have a practical discussion. And it's got to be what people can see, feel, smell, and touch. I can tell you for a fact that in New South Wales, the biggest state of Australia, 187 people were arrested for deliberately lighting fires in that bushfire. That's number one. Number two, that the clearing, the land clearing, as defined by a royal commission we had from the Black Saturday fires of 2008, the states were negligent in doing the backburning they were supposed to do for the clearing they were supposed to do in about 75% of the cases. So that's another reason why the fires happened. And also farmers are not allowed to clear their own land because of a lot of policies. So there were a lot of those contributing things, and there is a royal commission into this, and this will define what really happened and the role of climate change as well, right? That is also part of this. So I'm not saying that isn't, but I'm just saying there are also many underlying reasons why that took place. Now, let me talk about the practical discussion. And what I said, I was originally a total skeptic myself. But then I came to the conclusion logically, because I hate pollution. And I said, well, hold on a minute. What can people see, feel, and smell and touch? Well, go to LA, go to New York, on a bad day. And what do you see? Shocking smog. And you can smell it. And people die of respiratory disease because of the smog in the air. You go to other parts of the world, of course, it's a lot worse. So how, with all the garbage that factories and cars and all the things going up in the air, how can this not affect the environment? How can it not affect, the whole atmosphere? This is how I came to the conclusion that we have a problem, but it's a practical one. In other words, well, people are dying at the moment of respiratory disease because of the pollution that we put in the air. So how can we fix this? This is the discussion. When I told this to Marshall Saunders, he said, can you write this to me? Put it on an email, which I did, because it was a practical solution that common people can relate to and say, yeah, the pollution, some days it's really bad. And everyone can relate to it because they can smell it, see it, feel it, and touch it, and it hits close to home. Whereas when you talk about global warming and the impact of the higher temperature of 0.2 of a degree, that's a harder discussion to have. And with our back-end computing systems, and now I can talk from an IT perspective, we're not there yet. We'll probably need quantum computing to properly quantify a number of these various parameters and the precise effects they're having. Climate is most certainly changing. There's no doubt about that. So, my discussion now is how, from a market-based point of view, and the Citizens Climate Lobby also themselves are putting forward a carbon trading scheme that is market-based. That's why I like their whole approach. It's very practical and market-oriented. Now, in what we're doing, right, is how can we both help companies solve their bottom line. In other words, we're talking about the triple bottom line. How can we help companies reduce their capital costs, reduce their operating costs, and while improving, you know, productivity for their staff, people, guests, you know, visitors, whatever. And guess what? You have a winner. We have a winner. We have something that everyone can buy into, and that will help look after the planet. Wow. You know, hey, you know, we're onto something here. Now, if more people can do things like that, guess what? Companies will come on board because everybody wins. And I see, you know, I'm about getting stuff done. And if we can find ways to get stuff done, and it's going to help everybody along the way, guess what? You know, there'll be a lot more buy-in. And I think as a result of COVID-19, more companies will be looking at innovative solutions to reduce their costs. Because up to now, the companies making money were very lax, you know. And Warren Buffett actually made a quote some years ago that companies do not want to innovate if they're sitting pretty making money, right? They, not all, but most companies, they just relax. We don't need to save more money on energy or the operation because our staff numbers are about right. We've reduced the staff. We're okay. We don't need to. It's nice to have, but we don't need to. But in 2008, after the GFC, what happened? People moved to the cloud because they weren't afraid anymore of the cloud because they had to reduce their costs. This is what's going to happen with COVID-19. So the atmosphere here, as I suspect it will be in the US and Europe and everywhere, more companies will start to look at things beyond staff and say, okay, yes, you know, even if they're making money, they're going to be able to look and say, okay, what are practical ways? Well, if we introduce these cloud-based systems for managing our buildings and facilities and factories, wow, we can, you know, we can reduce energy by 30 or 40%. That's going to be a good contributor to the bottom line. Now we're open to the new technology. This is the sense I'm getting, and I think this will be a common thing around the world. Sorry for that long-winded.
No, that's good. That's good. I mean, you make some good points, and I'm completely on board with you that, you know, it's very difficult to solve problems if they're kind of in the abstraction of global warming and so forth. So it really needs to be at the level that people, you know, are impacted. And it needs to an extent, speak to their personal interest, right? So we really need, you know, commercial solutions that are on the market that are profitable businesses, but are also helping to achieve this common goal. I'm completely on board with you. So tell me a bit about who you are working with. I mean, are we primarily talking about commercial office buildings? Are you, you know, is the solution also scalable to more industrial type environments? What would be a typical deployment environment?
Okay, well, obviously we've started from office buildings is where we've started. Now we're working on our first hotel. So we're working with Accor, which of course is a very large operator, and we're also about to do an art gallery as well. And yes, look, this is expandable into oil and gas. It's expandable into manufacturing. It can go into agriculture. It go into maritime. It can go into a whole host of things: entertainment facilities, cinemas, shopping centres. We're expecting to work on our first shopping centre shortly as well. So this first system only ever went in December 2018, and yet we already have a number of case studies where, you know, the savings are absolutely incredible, up to 50% off the total electric bills.
So what is the, on your website, you compare to kind of a traditional BMS or BAS or, you know, SCADA-based system. What is the architectural difference or the difference in the technology that allows you to be more more cost effective in terms of the deployment, but also to, you know, achieve high efficiency improvements?
Okay, good question. Basically, firstly, the system is open. We use open APIs, which is very important. It's not proprietary, so the systems we use are non-proprietary for a start. Secondly, the architecture is wireless, not Wi-Fi. It's not suited to this scenario. It's a non-IP wireless network of sensors. And in fact, we've developed our own sensors using a traditional LoRaWAN network backbone, which is a long-range wide area network, a low-power network. And our sensors, in fact, are designed so we can send firmware updates over the air to tell it how and when to send data in order to preserve battery life which means we can up to double the life, in some cases up to 10 years. So we don't have to wire them up. Even Wi-Fi sensors, would you believe, require power, and they need power wiring to them unless you want to change battery every 2 weeks. So just to give you some comparison there. Our controllers that control, replace the traditional DDC controllers that control your actuators to open and close vents and control fans and chillers and things like that. They're all microprocessor-based, so we have edge computing on those, again, wireless communication, and we can, again, send firmware updates so they don't have to be hard programmed like traditional DDC controllers. So any update in logic is sent over the air and encrypted, authenticated on a non-IP network, and then it can run itself even if there's a disconnect from the cloud. So they run, so again, we don't have the Ethernet cabling or the BACnet Modbus RS485 or whatever proprietary cabling to the various actuators and systems in a building. So it saves a fortune on installation and time taken to install. The other thing is we have no central logic on site. All the central logic control is not in the supervisor, which the traditional BMSs have, but is in our analytics platform in the cloud. And all the rules, the global rules and logic is in the cloud, but then we send local rules to the individual controllers and they reside in those individual controllers till we change them. And so what that means is with that kind of an architecture is that we have a very agile system, but yet we're managing a whole ecosystem. Not just you have separate things controlling separate devices, but rather, you know, we manage the water flows, we manage the pumps, we manage the chillers, the air handling units, we manage all the different things, even the lighting and people going through and the meeting rooms. And so we don't have, for example, in a meeting room, if you have too many people and you're in a meeting, after an hour, you're getting sleepy and hot because your CO2 levels are above 1,000 parts per million. Well, we're able to control that and the amount of air and so forth so people don't fall asleep. So we don't have too much CO2. So we go into health and safety, air quality, dust particulates, mold within the building and a whole bunch of things like that. So it gets pretty detailed, but it's open. And even the data is owned by the client, unlike with the big companies where the data is owned by the vendors. And the best part is, in a traditional system, if you want to change something after you've put it in, so say you put it in 6 months ago and you want to make a major change, you have to call out the project managers, you have a bunch of meetings, you work out the logic, they bring the programmers out because we're changing the function of a number of rooms and what it's going to do, and we're going to change all the logic. That can take several months and $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to make a change. Well, on our platform, with the subscription service we have, which covers maintenance, it also covers, under premium and comprehensive, it covers logic changes. So we had a situation where one of our clients called us and said, look, in December, which is summer in Melbourne, at 7 in the morning when the system started, it was the heating went on. And he asked me why. And I said, well, we checked the data. It was 15 degrees Celsius, not Fahrenheit, which is quite cool. And I said, the system should start. But it was a 28 degree day that day, Celsius. So I understood what he said. And I said, so I think what you're saying is you want us on a warm day to ensure that it doesn't start with heating if we know we're going to have a warm day. So I said, okay, we can implement that look and have the system look at the weather forecast and decide whether the thing should start or not, or just the fans. So he said, yes, send me a variation. I said, no, I can't send you one. You're on a premium subscription. You're going to get it for free. So 6 logic changes in a year are done for free. So it means your operating cost is a lot lower because we don't, you know, hold people for ransom by the throat and say, oh, we got you, now we're going to charge you. Or if I want to add 2 more sensors, for example, and again, 10 minutes, because we can put the sensor in the right place because we don't have to wire it up at all, or a motion sensor even, and we can then put it in and then just add $20 a month or whatever to the subscription, and you don't have to pay another $20,000 to the vendor because you're changing your logic. So there's a lot. I have a comparison chart, actually, which depicts a whole lot more than what I've said. But they're some of the major highlights, you know. So the upfront cost is about traditionally around half that of a traditional system. And the ongoing savings are huge because we have a focus on optimizing continuously using machine learning, and we're building all of these things to ensure we're continually looking to improve performance the whole time. A traditional system, you get it, it's commissioned, and they leave. They say, thank you, if it breaks, come to us and we'll fix it under warranty, that's it. So a total difference. We permanently partner with our customers, whether it's through our channel partners, and we do have channel partners in the United States now and around the globe that we're setting up.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's very interesting. So you basically run through quite a number of the big cost levers that, you know, I see a lot of startups starting to deploy these, and a lot of the more traditional market leaders being a little bit tentative to deploy them because, you know, they impact their legacy businesses. So you talked about moving towards wireless and the cost improvement in the deployment of the system when you don't have to do the cabling, and also, of course, you avoid the cost of the, you know, the proprietary wired systems that are on the market. Talked about open source. I suppose when you're getting into machine learning and so forth, being able to work with open source solutions is a huge cloud processing, of course, and centralizing the logic in the cloud, kind of a SaaS model. I think this is very interesting. You basically integrated a lot of the big efficiency levers, and I think this is important for people to keep in mind when they're talking about IoT. Sometimes it's a little bit easy to get focused on, you could say, the kind of the cutting edge. And really, in most cases, that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is, how are the core functionalities becoming more cost-effective? You know, having more convenient form factors. You're talking about a 10-year battery life, so you don't have to send somebody out to change a battery. I mean, that costs, what does that cost? $50 per sensor to change, right? And so that for me is really, can be really the impactful innovation, right? It's about getting efficient systems. And it sounds like you're doing the system integration internally. Is it right that today you're kind of an integrated solution development and system integration house?
Yes. Yes, correct. We do it. Even the first controller, we built the board in-house, hand-soldered it from nothing. So we do that now. We, of course, outsource the manufacture. We have been making them in China. However, we're going to have alternate source of manufacture by later in the year. So we have two sources, one within China, which is primary. We'll have secondary source. So it might be other point in Asia or the United States for our components, sensors, IC boards, and controllers. But yes, we integrate the whole lot. So everything is very much integrated, though, you know, we work with, you know, various partners. We don't do asset management. We don't do FM management. So we can integrate and connect through APIs into these various platforms and collaborate.
With a system like this, there are, you know, there's the underlying architecture to collect the data and analyze the data. And then there are potentially a huge number of different applications that, you know, and a huge number of different users. You've already touched on energy efficiency. You've touched on building environmental controls and kind of health and safety issues. So you have multiple business functions that would have an interest in this, multiple stakeholders that might want to access the data or make requests. Who would be a typical buyer or initiator of a system? And how do you, I mean, maybe I have two questions here. One is on the stakeholder side, on who is purchasing these and making the decision given the number of stakeholders involved. And the second is building the applications to serve specific needs. Is that also something that you're doing primarily in-house, or have you found it possible to find narrow open source applications that you can kind of build on top of your platform? Because I imagine there's a lot of complexity then in solving specific end user needs and getting the application right, despite having, you know, the data at hand.
Yes. So, yeah, a couple of questions there. Certainly our primary target are building owners. So these are people who either own the buildings because it's their pocket. It's, you know, if you can reduce the cost of running a building, you improve the asset value because you're improving your yields. Because if I can have body corporate fees reduced and outgoings reduced because it's a higher efficiency building, it sends the value of the building higher. Also, if you're running the building yourself, again, you're saving money. So building owners, you know, whether it be a family office, whether it be a hotel operator, whether it be, or an FM company that holds responsibility for the operating costs. Some do, some don't. You know, if they don't hold the keys to the budgets, then they don't care. and they would rather not go for a newer technology because a lot of the people in the industry, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But by going to project managers, senior project managers who are putting projects together, usually in existing facilities, but we're starting now to talk to Greenfield. So these are the project managers or even construction companies putting together new builds. They're starting to come to us. And we're quoting on them. But certainly the people responsible for the budgets on an ongoing basis. So whether that's an owner or someone responsible for sustainability with teeth, you know, and there aren't many that have teeth, but the ones that do, again, because we're delivering outcomes. So we're also working with councils, local government councils, and now there's a bigger shift on it on the environment and energy savings. And so we're starting to take a hold on a number of councils as well, you know, helping them reduce their energy and improving their sustainability credentials. So anyone responsible for budgets, for the money, and for the outcome of those places or factories or buildings, they're the people we're talking to.
Gotcha. And so the big cost buckets here are, what is it? Primarily, I guess, energy consumption is number one. What would be the other big cost buckets that would be prioritized?
Energy, number one. Number two is maintenance. So, you know, quite often with traditional systems, it breaks. There's a lot of unplanned maintenance or even planned maintenance for that matter. So, for example, companies will have a regular thermal scan of a switchboard to make sure they're not going to get a short circuit, whereas we can have sensors in the board. So we know the temperature in the board. You don't have to have thermal scans. Or people will send your providers to go to look at the filters of your air conditioning systems every 6 months or 12 months. No need to do that. We measure pressure differential. So we know when to send people at the right time. But we also know in advance if a motor is going to break, right, by the sound, the vibration, by the power, the factor numbers that we get measuring the energy. So with all of that, we can reduce maintenance costs because we don't have to wait for it to break. We can then know in advance there's a problem, have it looked at, order parts in advance in an orderly fashion, and then have it repaired or replaced again in an orderly fashion. So we can dramatically reduce energy. And in places that use a lot of water, like the Middle East, and we're going to be working in the Middle East quite a lot, we'll be able to save a lot of water.
Okay, clear. Yeah, and that makes sense. So these would be owned by the building management company, BeastCost. And then there's, I guess, a separate set of, let's say, KPIs, but kind of softer KPIs that are around productivity. So making sure that you have an effective environment. So you mentioned earlier CO2. And there, I guess, is a different stakeholder group, right? The building management doesn't so much care about that. It's the tenants of the building. Are you able to make a value proposition directly to them? Or is this kind of like a soft, nice to have that's maybe not the primary value proposition?
Depends, because, you know, for companies like Dexus, I don't know if you've got Dexus in the US, but all the big JLLs, all these guys, a number of them are starting to get gold in the way they look after the buildings on not productivity, but on the occupancy, you know, on the satisfaction of people inside, because you've got things like Wells rating, for example, right? So you've got your LEED rating, of course, but then you've got Wells, which is, you know, how is it good for people? And how productive. So you've got your younger generations that want to work in offices that are really nice and have a nicer environment, you know. So companies that provide that environment will get better people, right? And this is how the argument goes. So from that point of view, we will add a value proposition around that. So more and more, it's still a small percentage, but more and more this will become more important. And yes, we will be able to add very, very good value propositions around that.
Yeah, I think this COVID-19 will have an interesting impact on how we view office buildings, right? As people get more comfortable working remotely, then you're going to have a better value proposition to bring people into the office, right? Which is not just you have to be here from 9 to 5, but this is an effective environment to get real work done. So it'll be interesting to see how that actually shapes the environment. Are you seeing much of an impact in these early weeks of the spread in terms of buildings already looking at how to add capability or insight into their management of buildings in response to COVID-19, or is that something that you expect to maybe see later in the year after people have had a more of a chance to digest the impact?
We'll see that later in the year, because at the moment, you know, people are just, they've got, you know, various companies, including global ones that we deal with. So we partner with companies like Thales, which is a global integrator, a French company, and they do a lot of work with, you know, governments and Department of Defense and so forth. And they're working from home, and many big companies, we've got their staff working from home. Others, like us, we're working in 4 square meters per, you know, which, you know, in your terms, I think is
40 feet per person.
40 feet per person or whatever. That's what the rules are for us. So we were, you know, much tighter than that, but now we're obviously adhering to the rules with that and doing that. So in terms of what you're saying, that will happen when this is over. And when this is over, people are going to start looking at though, that will become a discussion point, but we're too early for that discussion point yet. That will come.
Gotcha.
So give it 3 months. 4 months, and that will start. That will be one of the, well, you know, that will be certainly a discussion point around it. But what I think it may do, to be honest, is it will, because remember, we are social beings, right? By nature, we are social. Some people like to hibernate, you know, away. The majority of people don't. What this will mean is talk about, you know, how we can make offices a better place, how we can make them, you know, a place where people can communicate better, can collaborate better, and not just sitting in their own little cubicles, you know, which is a more of a traditional type office. So, yes, I think there's going to be a lot of those discussions held later this year.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking might be the outcome here, that, you know, because we were also thinking for our company, does it make sense to allow people to work from home more often? And on the one hand, if you're just going to be sitting at your desk working by yourself, then sure, work from home if you have a nicer environment at home. But of course, there's a lot of situations when you want to collaborate. And we'll probably see then a mix where people will maybe be working from home 50% of the time or 20% of the time when they don't need to collaborate openly. And that'll save a lot of commuting time. But then certainly there's a lot of circumstances where you need to collaborate, but then we can have greater square footage and, you know, not break up offices into little cubicles, but really transform them into more collaborative environments. It'll be interesting to see if this does play off or if it's kind of swept under the rug once people return to the norm. Bob, talk to me a little bit about you've already given us a good overview of the underlying architecture. What are the technology trends that you see developing right now and over the next, let's say, 5 years that you think will be impactful for you and how your company operates?
Okay. Well, of course, you've got the traditional providers. They're all saying, look, we're in the cloud now. Isn't it great? You can access our BMS from the cloud. Well, whoopee-doo. That's old technology. Anyone can get an IP address and over the web pick up something from somewhere. Well, wow, you know, they think they're in the 21st century. But anyway, that's a given a long time ago. But the real trends are certainly moving into more wireless or secured wireless technologies, low power wireless technologies. So we don't have to wire things up. That's certainly a given. The other one is moving to open platform. So those that want to keep proprietary, good luck to them. But that's not a good trend moving forward. And again, where data ownership is owned by the client, again, that's definitely a trend that we will see much more of. The other one that we'll see is, of course, the use of machine learning and AI. That's a big one. AI, a lot of people talk about AI at the moment, saying, we're using AI, you know, and there's one of the websites in the US, oh, we sweep, they've got a beautiful animation, wonderful animation. And, you know, we sweep across all these areas, and it's got a radar screen, you know. We sweep across all these areas of buildings and people with our AI, and, well, boy, what a crock, what another crock. But the marketing is just amazing, you know, the smoke and mirrors that they're using is something to behold. But all I can tell you is 99.99999% of people are not using AI at all. There is a small portion starting to use machine learning, and that is starting now, and a number of people have, as we do. But even we haven't yet got to the AI. We're about to start, right? And we're going to certainly be moving on that journey with AI in a more formal sense, because AI, you know, people use it, bandy it around. In most cases, it kind of means a smart set of rules, to be honest, but that's not true AI. So AI is going to certainly build in our space. The AI have been around in advertising, marketing, financial services for a long time, right? You know, using AI to, you know, interpret people's movements on your phone. You just went to this site. We'll advertise this, you know, and that's been around for a while. But in facilities, nah, it has not been. So it's all quite new. So then again, if you look at a video from Siemens, it will tell you when this motor is going to fail to the hour. Well, that is not possible at this stage. But at any rate, the moving into AI, more robotics, so maintenance, getting more maintenance done with drones and robotics, and knowing where all the assets are, that's happening now. Digital twins is another one. We're adopting digital twins, but what I call true digital twins, which is where we can take the 3D CAD model, the Rivet model, and then position the assets, see where the people are, and then do modelling off-site. If we change certain parameters, how will it affect the building? What can we do? But the AI will do all of that by itself. We're going to see a lot more of that, a lot more holograms, and certainly a lot more collaboration and democratization of data. So we can collaborate with other companies, what they're doing with buildings, and then swap information, then improve the optimization regimes that we do, and collaborating with other companies. So they might have algorithms, for example, for certain types of motors, so we can detect failures earlier. So we might license those. So in terms of the work they've done that we haven't done, and there'll be a lot of this sort of thing going on. We do have a front end, and so we've got the dashboards, but we might collaborate with others for different types of dashboards. So I can see lots of trends, lots of collaboration with different companies working together, partnering together, especially tech companies, in order to, you know, deliver really, really decent outcomes to, you know, various types of end users. That's really where I see the trend. So that will form a part of a net zero type scenario, even beyond net zero to net positive, where we're contributing to environments, so producing our own energy, local waste to energy within buildings, for example, generating more solar from walls and windows, and then managing that smartly with the automation systems as to where that excess energy goes. So we can swap using blockchain and swap power to other users, and it's billed automatically through blockchain, and rather than going back to a central energy retailer making a lot more money, but it's more, you know, democratized into smart grids, local microgrids. I can see a lot more of that sort of thing happening. So, you know, they're kind of general trends that I see moving forward.
Yeah, this point on collaboration is very interesting, because there, you could say the value is in many cases fairly apparent, right? In kind of underutilized space, underutilized data, energy wastage, and so forth. So there's a lot of data, but there is really very, very little collaboration around optimizing the value of this. And I think right now the technical challenges have, you know, largely been solved. Maybe not, certainly not entirely solved, but they're certainly very solvable in most cases. It's more than the business models, and it's the legal frameworks and how to enable this from an organizational perspective. And I think that's just a learning process of trial and error. And you know, once you have a few success cases, it'll be kind of follow the leader type process. So I'm fairly hopeful that we do become much more collaborative, you know, as we kind of prove out some of these value cases, and also just figure out where liability lies and so forth. I think that's really the challenge right now. So yeah, that's going to be a very interesting trend around data, but also around how we can use IoT to share other assets and other benefits that are currently being underutilized. Bob, could you walk us through? I think it's always quite useful to have somewhat of an end-to-end perspective of a solution, because otherwise, you know, it's kind of like the story of the elephant, right? You kind of look at it from different perspectives, and you get a little bit of a feel of what we're talking about, but it's hard to understand then the whole perspective. Can you walk us through end-to-end in one of your more recent deployments? Who are you first engaging with? What were the problems being solved, et cetera, through deployment?
Yep, sure. So we have a recent one that we implemented in October last year. That's a council building. It's a 40-year-old building. In fact, it's 40, 45, 47 years. Very old building. And they've got a mixture of 40-year-old infrastructure and 20-year-old HVAC infrastructure. And it was very problematic. They've got a mixture of packaged air conditioning systems, heating systems. They've got a central system with a big air handling unit and a huge fan and a huge compressor, driving it with separate boilers for the hot water to provide heating in there. They've got 19 mixing boxes, running a proprietary bus on a traditional BMS, and very little visibility. You had to go into the plant room. They upgraded it 5-7 years ago, and you could at least go to a PC in the plant room to see what was going on. But other than that, there wasn't a lot you could do with it if you wanted to change anything other than your set point temperatures and things like that. It was a major change in cost. And the line, the bus line to all the actuators in the mixing boxes that lets both hot and cold air in at once. So they're all over-engineered because in those days, energy was cheap and you could mix hot and cold air to get what you want. It was a proprietary bus. It wasn't even a Modbus line. It was just, it was proprietary. So they had very little visibility. If something went wrong, they didn't know. They had to go down to the plant room from another building somewhere else. And temperatures in different zones were up and down and all over the place. So it was very hard to manage. Energy costs were very high. So basically, we were engaged. We had done another one of their buildings. They were very happy with that. So this is a council not too far from us, actually, in Melbourne. And so they engaged us to replace this BMS system. And so what we had to do was rip out the old controllers running these 40-year-old actuators that opened the vents for the hot and cold air, the mixing boxes. And believe it or not, our brand new technology controllers were able to run these 40-year-old actuators in replacement of the old controls. They were wireless, so we didn't have to rewire a new cable into all these things. And then we put in a variable speed drive to control the supply air fan. It was 22 kilowatts, which is quite substantial. And then we put temperature probes in the supply air ducts. We're controlling the individual mixing boxes and the amounts that the vents would open by whatever percentage. And then we're measuring the water flows and temperatures through a condenser water loop system. And anyway, we took over. It took a few months to put it together. And then in October, we commissioned this last year. Immediately upon commissioning with the system, we found in the first month of operation, we saved 72.5% of HVAC energy and 45% off the total electricity bill. Now, the way we compare this is comparing the utility bill for the previous year. So same office usage, same number of working days. So we normalize the working days in that billing period. It's an office building, very easy to normalize. And so we compared the number of working days and the billing numbers from the utility bill, and that's how we determine the savings. So unequivocal savings, much better human comfort, full visibility to all the facilities people and ops people throughout the organization from their device, from wherever they are. Doesn't matter, they could be home, they could be in Moscow for that matter, doesn't matter. So they can engage through the web interface, through Active Directory. So if they leave, then they can't view anymore and control. They can change set point temperatures, they can change dead band control, they can do all sorts of things from their phone or their desktop, wherever they are, in full control of the building. And then with that, they get there's monthly reporting provided, which gives them the analytics. Mind you, they've got live dashboards on power usage and energy consumption and all of that. But we analyze the data and give them monthly reporting as well, which comes with it, and they're very happy. So we're in the process of giving us an art gallery at the moment, another new building they're putting in, and a whole lot of other things. Aquatic center is another one. So they're just happy. We've got several buildings now with them, and they're so happy we are delivering true outcomes and we deliver what we say. So we have this published, by the way, this case study. It is available. I can send it to you.
Yeah, that would be great. And we can certainly publish this along with the link to the case study along with the podcast. Yeah, that sounds great. It's very practical use case. And I think these real-term and kind of near-term impacts make it much easier to justify the investment in an IoT system, and then you can kind of build other other functionality and value on top of that. So it sounds like the cost here is broken down between the capex of the equipment, the system integration cost, and then an ongoing SaaS cost that also includes maintenance. And you mentioned that the installation is roughly maybe 50% of what a traditional system, maybe not giving us the exact, you know, quote for this project, but could you give us a range for what a building might look like from, let's say, the upfront deployment cost and then the SaaS?
Yep. Okay. Well, yeah, certainly. Well, basically, let me wrap that up first. So I'm going to go reverse. What I'm going to do, I'll give you all of that. But what I'm going to tell you is your payback, right? What? Because people say, well, that's all very nice. But, you know, what does that mean for the bottom line, right? When do I get my money back? How long does it take, right? I mean, you know, like the, this assumes you don't have to change something in a brownfield building. This assumes your current one is working properly. If it's not working properly, then, you know, you've got to change it anyway, right? But let's say you don't have to. Typically, we're talking around 2.5 year payback, right? So we're talking, and that includes subscriptions, right? That includes your subscriptions, so, and your CapEx. So that's, you know, where we can start the discussion. Typically. So now let me go back in a typical building. So we've just put together a quote for a 24-story building. In your parlance, in square feet, we're talking about 10, maybe nearly 300,000 square feet, 250 to 300,000 square feet of a building. And that came out at about, with installation, somewhere around, I'm going to translate this into US dollars, right? Australian dollars, we're looking at around 620, and this is a what we call a retail price, like, you know, what an end user would pay, somewhere around about 620,000 Australian dollars, but in US dollars, that's going to be more like around 350, 370, somewhere around there, 370,000 US dollars. Fully installed, something like that, which then on top of that, so that includes your physical install, all the hardware, all the software integration, reporting setup, logic, programming, everything. So that's all the upfront cost. And then your subscriptions will typically, we have three levels of subscription, but premium or comprehensive will give you all the service, including data interpretation by domain experts, electrical, mechanical, and controls engineers as part of the subscription. So we identify issues and report them and make sure we're working with your contractors to ensure that we're finding problems and eliminating them. So we get rid of waste that's unknown and keep optimizing your usage. On that, you'd be looking around 15% of the capital cost annually for your subscription for premium. So in the example I gave at 350,000 USD, then you'd be looking at what, 35 and another 17, around $52,000 USD, around $52,000 USD per year, which is around 15% of the capital cost per year. But that includes hardware warranty extension, telephone support. You get a whole lot of services, including the engineering team and data interpretation, regular reporting, the dashboards, the cloud services, you know, the whole operation and the logic in the cloud, analytics and open APIs, connectivity to other platforms, all of that forms part of that service. So we kind of never leave. A traditional BMS company, what they do is it's commissioned. If it breaks, you call them back to fix it, but you're left to fend for yourself. The problem is facilities managers, building managers haven't got time to interpret data unless it's broken. They go out and fix it. But what we're doing is we're permanently there to make sure we're looking after the interests of our clients and finding issues and then giving them and reporting on it, and letting them know when they need to through alerts or direct to their contractors. And then they can go out physically on site to check. Yes, we found a problem. You identified this. We have now rectified it. Are we getting improved energy performance now? We don't have to wait for it to fall over and break or cause discomfort, that kind of thing. So does that give you, you know, a kind of an idea? That's a pretty decent sized building that I gave you the example of. And, you know, that would certainly be much more cost effective than the traditional system.
Yeah, no, that's very clear. I appreciate your transparency. And I think this is, you know, really at IoT One, we spend a lot of time assessing different solutions. And one of the things that's the most exciting for me that you know, gives me the most hope for this, you know, this larger market in the future is solutions just like this that are very, very practical, very directed, and are really very affordable. I mean, it's all about companies being able to realize some ROI so that they can justify the investment and then build on top of that, right? But you need to get a starting point, and that starting point needs to be something super practical. I think companies are tired of these, you know, IoT for IoT's sake, AI for AI's sake. It needs to be, this for me is incredibly important, exactly these types of solutions. Bob, anything else? I want to be cognizant of your time. I think anything else that you wanted to touch on today?
Well, just the fact that we are setting up in your neck of the woods. So I have established a company there called Blue IoT LLC, registered in Delaware. But we've also got a local channel partner that's starting, and we expect to be working in the US after this. I would imagine, I'm hoping our first project will probably start maybe by July, is what I'm thinking. In the Middle East, we'll be starting in June. It'll be, you know, great moving in that US and Canadian marketplace, and then eventually into Canada, South America, I guess, once we've established well in the United States. And so I think, you know, I'm very excited actually with the US market myself, because, you know, companies there tend to be more pragmatic, and they will now be more open to new technologies in order to achieve a better bottom line outcome while helping the environment at the same time. So with everybody winning, people will be far more open to now finding new ways to do things better. I think that'll be a positive outcome of this COVID-19.
Perfect. Well, I hope there is some silver lining on this. So that would be, then long term, that would be nice to look back at. Bob, I really appreciate your time. Certainly, we will we'll put your website online, and people can figure out how to contact you there. If you'd like to email me the details for your channel partner in the US, then we can also put the, you know, post this along with the podcast. Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate the conversation today.
Great. No worries. I'll send you a copy also of the case studies concern and some links to articles, remembering that we also won the FMA Facilities Management Association Award for Industry Innovation last November. They're our peak body in facilities. And the IoT Pioneer Award we won in June from Next Media. And they do IT news, computer reseller news, and IoT Hub in Australia. So I'll send you some links to these as well, and I'll certainly look forward to talking to you in the future.
Excellent. Then, Bob, we'll get that all posted, and have a great day ahead.
No worries. Same to you. Keep safe.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Industrial IoT Spotlight. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at IoT1HQ and to check out our database of case studies on IoT1.com. If you have unique insight or a project deployment story to share, we'd love to feature you on a future edition. Write us at eric.walenza@IoT1.com.